Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by Arnold Golden and Gregory.
Welcome to Energy Matters, a show about how you can save money on your utility bills, use technology wisely, and live a more sustainable lifestyle. Here's your host, veteran energy regulator and clean energy expert, Commissioner Tim Echols.
Thank you, Scott Slade. It is a great day to be talking about energy, saving money on your bill, living more sustainably, and using all the available technology that you can get. I'm Tim Echols, the host of Energy Matters. Welcome to our show today. We do have an exciting show. We've got in studio with me my co-host today, Casey Boyce. Casey, welcome back.
Good morning, Tim.
And Casey, tell us a little bit about the company you work for.
So I'm with a company called Escalent. We help companies, including energy utilities, understand and work with their customers better. And yeah. I live in the great city of Decatur.
Yeah, great having you back. And Dr. David Gaddy from the University of Georgia, from the engineering department. Dr. Gaddy, we've talked about you a number of times on the show, and I think we've had you over one other time, but you recently testified before Congress back in December of 2019, and we really want to dissect that whole opportunity and everything that was said there. So it's great to have you in studio.
Thank you. I appreciate y'all having me here, Tim.
Dr. Gaddy, tell us a little bit about the opportunity that you had to go to Congress. Who got you up there, and was it scary? Give us a little bit of the human part of the experience.
One of the staffers reached out to me, Tim. This was probably sometime back in about maybe April or May. They had seen some of my commentaries and op-eds and some of the things that I've been writing over the past few years on not just nuclear in particular, but energy policy in general. And they reached out to just start a conversation. For the most part, the House Energy and Commerce Committee was then, of course, it was, you know, the majority party is the Democrats, so they were really leaning in on climate change policy, looking at climate change policy. And so the staff reached out to me because I had, in a lot of my articles, had written about some of the dualities of nuclear's benefits being not only reliability and security, but also its climate benefits. So they reached out and wanted to just have a conversation, which we had actually over the course of several months. They had a series in the subcommittee, the Environment and Climate Change Subcommittee. I think this was one that Speaker Pelosi had prompted back when the Democrats took over the House. They had this subcommittee formed, and they had a series of hearings dating back probably to about June, July, August, and this was the culminating hearing in December. And so they were looking at placing me in one of those hearings, but I think finally when this one came up, they were looking at how to get to a 100% carbon-free economy, and a lot of the policies coming from the Democrat side were about carbon taxes. And so they wanted me to give a little bit of a different voice. And I don't know if you've had a chance to look at my testimony. It's only 40 pages. I expect you to have read it by now and had it on, you know, by heart. You've got it, right?
I listened to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that wasn't the 40-page recitation.
No, I haven't read the 40 pages.
There are graphs, right?
There are lots of graphs.
It's a summary.
But the point in what I was projecting in my testimony was with regard to, you know, what the real impact of a zero carbon U.S. economy could actually have on global climate change. And that was what they wanted me to bring to the committee hearing, was to just try and balance some of the, just for lack of better words, some of the myopia on a carbon tax, because that was kind of taking over a little bit of the taking a lot of the air out of the room. And the three other folks on the hearing that day, very fine people, smart as a whip, you know, smarter than me, Tim Profeta out of Duke and Noah Kaufman from Columbia University and Dan Estee from Yale. I kind of felt real out of place. These were three high-profile private universities.
Hey, don't be intimidated by those Ivy League
guys. No. I wasn't intimidated. I just said I felt a little bit out of place, maybe, because these were three private universities. Here I was from the land-grant university. But the point there being, I was the first, you know, we were the first land-grant university in the country. So I was proud of that.
That's right.
So, to the point about, was it nervous? Was it? I think I've had so many of these talks. I have presented this to so many people over the past several years to some pretty large groups. I wasn't very nervous about my case, about my point, about my policy principles that I wanted to convey.
Let me jump in and Casey, I was at UCLA in December for a conference, mm-hmm. a clean energy conference. And one of the things I discovered out there in Los Angeles at this conference was that clean means different things to different people.
It sure does.
And a lot of these cities, run by mostly Democrats, and full disclosure to my audience, I'm a Republican. I regulate energy here in Georgia. I have seven kids. I'm very much a Republican, though I drive an electric car, and I obviously promote renewable energy on this show. But Casey, there is some argument over what clean means, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've seen communities that are talking about renewable and saying that it's got to be a renewable source to be clean. Some people say, well, hydro isn't even renewable because it's got a negative environmental impact. So, you know, there's really a lot of squishiness to that term clean. And I like the focus, Dr. Gaddy, on this idea of, you know, low to no carbon economy. That is a quantifiable thing as opposed to quote unquote clean.
Right.
And Casey,
right.
One of the other things, and throughout this show today with Dr. Gaddy, and he is a doctor, not a medical doctor. He is a doctor. he is a smart guy. But one of the things that I'm going to complain about, Casey, is what I view as a little bit of hypocrisy on the part of some of these officials around who will, they'll use the word clean. They don't necessarily say what it means exactly. They give themselves all kind of escape clauses, mm-hmm. right? So they'll set a goal to have 100% clean, quote unquote, by 2040, by 2050, by 2060. In many instances, there's no kind of a law or an ordinance requiring that. It's just a resolution, all right? And it really could be changed by the next group of politicians that came in. It's a little bit hypocritical.
Well, and I'll tell you what. I spent a number of years working with cities and counties on climate change. And this was back in the late aughts, I guess. I don't know if that's the official term, 2007, 2008.
But it's understood.
It's understood. Okay, good. And every time a mayor would come out and say, hey, we are committed to reducing our emissions, you know, they get lots of press, rah, rah. Nothing's happened since. It's been a decade. Cities really have not made that much progress, even those that said we're going to achieve deep reductions. I'm done giving kudos for press releases. What matters now is action, right?
You know what, Casey? Rhetoric. If you live out there on Twitter like I do, or you attend a lot of events like I do, it seems like a lot of folks in the environmental left, they're very happy to get that rhetoric. They love for someone to say, oh, I believe in this, or I want that. And I tell them, look, it doesn't matter what anybody says. What are they doing, right? What kind of policies are they creating? What kind of transitions are they actually making? Are they driving an electric mm-hmm. car? Have they put solar on their home? Are they living this? Are they just preaching this
right.
to other people? Well, let's do this. I want us to get into the first 4 minutes of this audio, and we're going to jump back in at the end of this segment, where we're going to spend the whole show today doing a postmortem on Dr. Gaddy's visit to Washington, D.C., some of the things he said, why he said it. Let's jump in, and the chairman of the committee is going to kick the meeting off, and here we go.
So today we're going to hear about options for robust, comprehensive, and economy-wide policy solutions to hit that target. We'll hear about the essential role the federal government can play. And again, if I can go back to the weekend conference, I think that everyone knows that the state and the local governments continue to play a major role and can do a lot of the things that we need to do to reach the target. of 2050, but it's not enough. The federal government has to get involved. So finally, we're going to hear about how economy-wide climate action will not only reduce emissions, but will also stimulate the economy. By investing in the low and zero carbon technologies of the future, the U.S. can become a world leader in clean energy innovation. And I look forward to hearing from our witnesses about that. And thank you again, Chairman Tonko, and I yield back.
So back in the studio, he yielded back. So I'm going to take over here the mic. I've got David Gaddy, Dr. David Gaddy from UGA Engineering School with me, and Casey Boyce, my co-host. Guys, that just a minute from the chairman there is quite juicy. He talked about hitting a 2050 target. He talked about the role of federal government, state governments, local governments in this. He talked about how he felt the federal government must get involved. And this is something that, frankly, I've pushed back on. And, of course, this is assuming that we need the target in the first place. Casey, I mean, you travel the country. He's talking about these targets. You're seeing, 2050 is his target, but a lot of cities I talk with, they have other targets,
yeah, 2030,
right?
Others. And it depends what your baseline year is, and it depends on what your percent reduction is. And so, I mean, honestly, I'm not a federal government guy, but that's one thing that it has going for it is standardization.
Yeah, you know, I'm just concerned, one, that CO2 become this most important thing in our lives, right? Dr. Gaddy, they didn't mention about the other pollutants involved,
no,
right?
No, in fact, you know, to the point of what y'all were speaking to earlier about clean, I'm generally, everywhere I go, when you say clean energy, they are speaking specifically of CO2. They're not, to your point, Tim, they're not talking about SO2 and NOx and particulate matter and mercury and things like that. If you go to other countries, clean energy means human health.
Well, we're gonna keep this conversation going. We got so much to cover. Stick around. We're going to continue to hear from Dr. Gaddy, his trip to Congress. I'm Tim Echols. You're listening to Energy Matters.
Gas South believes in the difference we can all make, like the difference in putting people first and showing that you care. For us, our difference is saving people money with our best rates and no deposit, and the difference we make in our community by taking care of our friends and neighbors and giving back 5% of our profits to help children in need. Learn more about what makes us different at GasSouth.com. Gas South. The difference is good.
BMVW is the place in Metro Atlanta to get your used hybrid, plug-in hybrid, or fully electric car. They're located on the south side near the airport, but it is well worth the drive. Go online to look at their inventory at ev-hybrid.com and set up a time to see the vehicle or even drive it for up to 3 days. I don't know of anywhere else in Metro Atlanta that you can do that. That's ev-hybrid.com, the best deal in town. ev-hybrid.com, ev-hybrid.com. This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by Arnold, Golden, and Gregory, an AmLaw 200 law firm with 180 attorneys in Atlanta and Washington, D.C. They take a business sensibility approach when advising clients. They provide industry knowledge, attention to detail, transparency, and value to help businesses and individuals achieve their definition of success. AGG subscribes to the belief not if, but how. We thank John Gornall and all the attorneys and staff at AGG for sponsoring our show. Hey, this is Tim Echols. We're back with Energy Matters, and in the studio with me, my co-host Casey Boyce. Casey,
howdy, Tim.
Yeah, good to talk to you. You're from Decatur. You drive an electric car, and we're talking about something near and dear to my heart today: nuclear energy. We've got Dr. David Gaddy in the studio. Dr. Gaddy appeared before a congressional committee back in December 2019, and we're kind of doing a post-mortem on the whole experience. Casey, you've had a chance to listen to his testimony, and we're going to play his testimony momentarily. It was a great opportunity for Dr. Gaddy. Casey, I'm going to play Dr. Gaddy's testimony and then unpack it, and we're going to link to the full testimony on our Twitter feed at Matters Radio. So let's go ahead and roll Dr. Gaddy's appearance before the U.S. Congress.
I want to thank the chairman, the ranking member, members of the subcommittee for the opportunity to come before you today. My testimony aligns with the following points. America is facing two national security threats, one around climate change and the other around the U.S. nuclear power enterprise. Climate change is global in cause and impacts, and as carbon emissions increase globally, those impacts won't stop at U.S. borders simply because we have an aggressive domestic climate policy. The U.S. economy and its industrial capacity should be leveraged to innovate and deploy low and zero carbon technologies in developing economies where carbon emissions are of greatest concern. Nuclear power should be central to U.S. policy, with a strategy to develop advanced reactor technologies for domestic and international deployment. And America must engage in climate issues globally with national security as the overarching objective. Globally, energy consumption and carbon emissions are increasing, not decreasing. From 2000 to 2018, 90% of the increase in carbon emissions originated in Asia-Pacific countries, predominantly China and India, while emissions in the U.S. declined. Under the most aggressive carbon policy, eliminating all U.S. emissions would reset global emissions to 2006 levels, meaning if climate change was a threat in 2006 with U.S. emissions, climate change is a threat in 2018 without U.S. emissions. While exponential growth in non-hydro renewables is elevating hopes that renewables are closing the gap on fossil fuels, that gap isn't closing, it's expanding. For the past 10 years, over 81% of global wind and over 82% of global solar were concentrated in countries with substantial fossil fuels, nuclear, and/or hydro built into their economies, meaning traditional energy resources have provided the foundation for renewables to expand. This recommends a global triage approach with resources and efforts directed toward regions where the issue is acute or emerging. In developing regions, countries are at various stages of economic growth, therefore it's necessary to determine which energy technologies can be deployed effectively to sustain low-carbon economic development. One such technology is nuclear power. Early U.S. nuclear policymakers recognized the strategic importance of America's nuclear enterprise. To them, nuclear wasn't just another energy commodity, the fate of which should be dictated by political calculus, popular opinion, or market forces alone. Rather, it was central to America's foreign policy, so their approach was principled and strategic, not populist and transactional. A key objective was to create the world's most advanced nuclear technology base from which mutually beneficial global partnerships could be established within the emerging liberal international order. The 21st century is undergoing geopolitical shifts, and China and Russia are leveraging state-owned nuclear enterprises as extensions of the state to establish long-term energy and technology dependencies. If U.S. policy orients our technology trajectory away from nuclear, it will signal to the world that America has set aside its commitment to be a reliable partner in nuclear development, thus opening the door for China and Russia. Efforts to decarbonize the U.S. economy will require investment. If the return on that investment is only a near-term reduction in U.S. carbon emissions, the U.S. will remain vulnerable to climate change over the long term as global emissions increase. The U.S. cannot insulate itself from the impacts of global climate change through domestic policies targeting only the U.S. economy. Therefore, U.S. climate policy must be global and strategic, keeping in mind that if the U.S. transitions away from current energy interdependencies, those interdependencies can develop into vulnerabilities open to exploitation by energy-rich and technology-advantaged countries that don't share America's values. To that end, U.S. policy should focus on developing energy and technology relationships within developing regions, cultivated as international investment opportunities for U.S. industry, and coupled to diplomatic efforts of U.S. engagement and goodwill. Lastly, the national security implications of U.S. nuclear power simply cannot be overstated. While nuclear has proven its value to America, its contributions remain on the horizon as economic development, climate change, and national security converge into a perfect storm of 21st century global challenges that nuclear is capable of addressing. The U.S. cannot be an energy and climate island. America must engage globally, and it must do so with national security as its overarching objective. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Dr. Gaddy, that was pretty impressive as you shared that. Was it intimidating looking all those, members in the eye, as well as TV cameras and clicking cameras and radio mics?
You know, Tim, it wasn't so much intimidating. It was just really awesome to be in a place like that, just the greatest democratic institution in the world. It was a good thing.
Questions. We want to unpack this a little bit for our listeners. So one of the things that you talked about, Dr. Gaddy, was developing advanced nuclear technology. What exactly is that?
So currently, right now, we're looking at, in the U.S., probably globally for the most part, we've been using light water reactors since the 50s and 60s. The things that we're looking at doing long term here, KC, are things like small modular reactors. I think I've heard y'all talk about that here on Energy Matters. That's one thing. There are also some other more non-proliferation type reactors, such as the molten salt reactors. Several of those designs are still out there. We actually had some very robust nuclear research going on back in the 70s and 80s. The experimental breeder reactor was one that was developed at Argonne. It was a fast reactor. It was integrated, and it was one that could actually take nuclear waste and use it as a fuel. So it essentially cut the storage disposal time for nuclear waste from thousands of years down to a couple of hundred years. So we've still got a lot of work that we can do out there that'll lend itself to the waste issues, the waste stream issues, and just it'll extend the life of a lot of these reactors for many, many years.
So I've been hearing about things like small modular reactors for decades. And as far as I know, they're not commercialized. How far away are we from actually seeing some of this stuff?
Inside of 10 years. So NuScale will have theirs up probably inside of about 10 years. There'll be some over. South Korea's got some that are in research, in the research phase and development phase. And there'll be others. Russia, China, Japan, and those, they're working on small modulars as well. But I think our first one here in the U.S. is going to be probably that NuScale reactor. And again, those are light water reactors. There are also small modulars that are molten salt type reactors. And some of those you'll see coming out of Canadian firms like Terrestrial Energy.
Dr. Gaddy, I'm a huge fan of nuclear energy, a huge promoter. Obviously, I've voted to move Plant Vogtle forward, and we're building two Westinghouse AP1000 reactors there. But I tell you, Dr. Gaddy, I just don't know that a single state like Georgia, and we're the only state in America building a nuclear reactor, I don't know that you can put the burden of proof of concept onto a state like Georgia and our ratepayers and have us really be able to do it. I just feel like we need some other financial model. After doing this one time with Vogtle, I don't know that I would ever enter into it again under the same type of financial arrangement.
Right, particularly now, Tim, that natural gas is as low as it is, of course. But at the time, and you go back on this as well as anybody, but at the time, that was the right decision. It was the right decision in 2009 for the state of Georgia to move forward. I agree with you. We can't place the burden of things like this on the back of a single state's ratepayers. Agreed and understood. But as a forward-looking strategy, there are things the U.S. is simply going to have to step up here and make decisions on. My contention in this testimony is that nuclear power is not simply just another energy commodity. It is a national security issue that the U.S. decided back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s would be at the center of our foreign policy and national security issue. So,
how come we can't go out to the Savannah River site, which is a national lab, and have the federal government do a grant to build one of these advanced reactors, perfect the design there? They can sell the electricity to neighboring communities and perfect that with those federal dollars, and then let it be commercialized after that's done. I mean, will that model work?
Well, it's fair enough. We had some of that research going on. I just mentioned that to KC. We had that research going on. It was very close. It was shut down in, I think, 93 or 94. I think President Clinton did it in his State of the Union. But again, I'm going to push a little bit here and tell you that we are going to have to do something more long-term and systemic. And one of my suggestions, and this is something that I submitted in a follow-up to the Energy and Commerce Committee, is we need to do a thorough industrial base review of where we are in our U.S. nuclear enterprise. Where is America in its nuclear enterprise? Sort of bottlenecks? And
let's hold that thought. I want us to come back in the next segment and continue to talk about what it takes to make this feasible in the United States of America. Stick around. I'm Tim Echols. You're listening to Energy Matters. We'll be right back.
Creative Solar USA is a Georgia-based turnkey installer of innovative solar panel systems. They're dedicated to energy solutions for both your home and business. With their NABCEP certified installers, they ensure their clients receive the highest quality of solar energy systems in the industry. Contact CSUSA today at 770-485-7438 or go to creativesolarusa.com.
Hey, this is Tim Echols. We talk all the time on Energy Matters about buying a used EV instead of a new one. Let someone else pay the depreciation. BMVW Auto Sales, one of our show sponsors, can fix you up. Go to their website at ev-hybrid.com to see the ever-changing inventory. BMVW has every brand, every type of EV, and they'll even let you test drive it for 3 days, show you how to charge it and drive it for maximum performance. That's ev-hybrid.com. ev-hybrid.com.
This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by BMVW Auto Sales.
Welcome back. I'm Tim Echols, host of Energy Matters, and we're really going at it in the studio today. I've got Casey Boyce, my co-host, who can hardly get a word in edgewise. Casey,
howdy, Tim.
Because we never really talk about nuclear energy very much, but it is a passion of mine, right? I mean, I'm known.
So I've heard.
Yeah, I'm kind of known for that. And here I've got, you know, one of the foremost authorities on, you know, on nuclear energy policy in the studio.
And the two of you are going at it like cats and dogs.
Yeah, we are, and we're going to continue to go at it. So in the last segment, we listened to Dr. Gaddy's testimony, which was a little over 5 minutes, a summary of his testimony before the U.S. Congress from December 2019. Now, remember, Casey, this was a democratically controlled committee. They had their own climate change agenda, and Dr. Gaddy was invited to come in with a guy from Duke and a guy from Columbia and a guy from Yale to present this information. And Dr. Gaddy, he is a great evangelist for nuclear energy and nuclear policy. So, Casey, I do want to go ahead and give you a chance to chime in here because I'm very pumped about having him in the studio. Casey, after listening to the testimony, hearing our argument, I mean, what are some questions that you have for Dr. Gaddy?
Well, look, I am not as much of an advocate as either of you are. I tend to be skeptical on new nuclear, which, I'm biting my tongue a little bit over here. But one of the things that you said in your testimony, Dr. Gaddy, that struck me that I'd love to hear a little bit more about is you mentioned this gap between the development of renewable energy resources, which have come down enormously in cost, and the installation across the country has gone up as well as around the world, and the gap between that generation and fossil generation, and that we need nuclear presumably to help fill that gap. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, Casey, it was kind of a central point of what I was trying to get across in the hearing. To your point, you're right. The cost of, particularly the levelized cost of solar and wind have come down exponentially, whatever that phrase would be, over the past several years. And what I often hear when I'm talking energy policy is I hear that renewables are growing exponentially. And it's one of the points I make in my testimony is they actually are growing exponentially. But when they're put in the same context of the growth of fossil fuels, that gap between what we are deploying in non-hydro renewables and what we're deploying in fossil fuels, that gap is what matters most. Renewables can grow as exponential as they want, but if fossil fuel consumption is not going down, we gain no ground.
So, Dr. Gaddy, I'm sorry to jump in here.
No, he's
Dr.
not Gaddy, sorry.
What you're saying that if we close an existing nuclear power plant, like we did with Vermont Yankee, like we did with the Pilgrim plant in Massachusetts, if we close a plant and replace it with natural gas, as cheap as it is, that from a climate change perspective, we're really going backwards. Is that right?
That's right. I'm saying that if we displace zero carbon resources with carbon resources, of course we're going backwards. Of course.
But the environmental left seems to wink at that. They seem to say, well, it doesn't really matter because I don't know why. I don't know why, Casey. Maybe I mean, you live in Decatur. Maybe you can tell me. But why is it that the environmental left is so at war with nuclear energy?
I don't know. No, I mean, I think the big issue, right, that a lot of environmentalists have, and just to be clear, I am not part of or don't consider myself to be part of the environmental left. But I think the issue is that the magnitude of risks from something like a Chernobyl or Fukushima level disaster, as well as the question of what do you do with the waste from nuclear power, are so large and so unknown to a lot of people that there's real concern out there. And, you know, unlike a nuclear accident, you know, a solar spill is a nice day, right? And so I think there is, you know, that's coloring a lot of it. Now, I think, you know, where I agree with you guys is we shouldn't be shutting down our existing nuclear reactors. When we've got existing carbon-free generation sources, why don't we maximize their lifetimes? I'm just skeptical that something like these small modular reactors coming in 10 years is going to beat something that I can put on my house today with a solar panel.
So, Tim, I'll add a little bit to answer your question. There is a firm belief system that renewables can substitute for nuclear power, and maybe not in the near term, but in the long term, they are going all in that battery storage is absolutely going to be there to scale.
Saying there's a belief, or do you think it's a reality? It could be a reality.
I said belief. It is a belief. And I don't accept it.
And I think that is true. I think it's both battery storage and demand flexibility that the belief is that we'll figure that out, but we do not have it figured out today. Honestly, I think that's a lot easier to figure out than nuclear engineering, but I'm not an engineer.
So actually, it's not. I'd rather go with a reactor than that. But again, to push this further, all of what we just talked about, demand management and all that, does not matter in developing economies. They don't need less energy. They need more energy. And if it is not reliable, storable energy, such as coal, but in this case nuclear, they're not going to gamble their future on renewable energy.
So to your point about the gap, let's take a country that's not developing. Let's take one of the premier engineering countries in the world, Germany. Germany is set to turn off all of their reactors, nuclear reactors, by 2022. But yet their goal to turn off their coal is 2038. So back to your point about one step forward, two steps back, that's my version of your testimony, is that if the Germans turn off the remainder of those reactors and continue to burn the fossil fuel, they've cut off their carbon-free resource, and they've had to replace it with something. Maybe it's the wind if the wind's blowing. Maybe it's the solar if the sun is shining. But it very well could be another fossil fuel that they're having to import from one of their EU neighbors, right?
Or they're going to step up their import of nuclear from France.
Yeah, and they can import without penalty. They have a very free trading system over there. We've talked about the EU trading system on this show before. And, you know, Dr. Gaddy, it's so strange. I mean, we talked about this hypocrisy early in the show. And I do have German friends. I am a fan of German engineering. Please, my audience, don't think I'm just going after the Germans here. But the Germans told me, and these are ministry leaders, utility executives, I said, don't you have a problem importing French nuclear energy when you know, have a need, when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing? And they said, No, not really, because we just don't want to have it here. We don't mind importing it. It is part of the EU law that we have to take it. We cannot discriminate import energy sources. We can't say to France, we just want your solar. We just want your wind, because an electron is an electron when it comes to EU policy. It doesn't mean any more that it's produced by a windmill or solar panel or a waterfall or anything else is valued at exactly the same.
But again, this, and I agree with all your points, but what Germany is giving us is a perfect example of a couple of things. One is, and I'll be quick, one is, this is what you get when policymakers get out in front of science and engineering reality. That is, they came up with a knee-jerk policy right after Fukushima, and they just didn't have the engineers in the room with them. They weren't there. It also tells you that if you're going to build renewables in your economy, the only precedent we have for growing renewables, and I have this in my testimony, is on the shoulders of traditional resources. There is no precedent for industrializing economy on renewables only. We have no precedent for that. So Germany's actually showing us that you can't do it unless you have a traditional energy resource base. That's what the U.S. is showing us. That's what every other country is showing us. We can't tell developing economies, how about give that renewables a shot and see how it works out for you?
And they're having to keep that coal. I often joke and say they're playing footsie with the coal, because when I confront them about the coal, it's like, well, there's a lot of jobs associated in East Germany and West Germany with our coal mines, and it's an important part of the South in providing their energy reliability, so we can build these fancy Mercedes and BMWs and Audis and Porsches. Casey, am I being too hard on my German friends here?
I don't think so. No, I mean, again, to the point I made earlier, if we've got carbon-free generation, we need to keep it. And I think the Germans shot themselves in the foot with that, as you said, a reactionary policy after Fukushima to say we're going to shut it down domestically. It was a bad decision for them. I think it's a bad decision for us where we've seen nuclear power plants shut down.
How much does it cost over there, Tim? What's a kilowatt hour electricity?
It's about three times what ours is.
Yeah.
But
so
they proudly
about 33-34 cents.
But they proudly say, but we use less.
Yeah.
And of course, they're not.
Because they can't afford it.
Well,
that's demand side management.
They are frugal people. I mean, I want to give them that. They're frugal people. They're conscientious. They have engineered themselves out of a pickle thus far. I mean, raising their greenhouse gases, but they've engineered themselves out of a pickle. But they're for sure not having seven kids like I am. They don't have no house with no seven kids.
When you have, I have three perfect children, and we stopped right there.
Yeah, yeah. So, but this is not a show about family planning. Well, look, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Getty because we're not done yet. We hope that you are getting as fired up as we are. We hope you'll engage with us on Twitter. The show's at Matters Radio. I'm at Tim Eccles.
Casey. And I'm at Casey Boyce on Twitter.
And Dr. Getty, even though you're a professor, you have a Twitter account.
You know that. I tweet and Facebook. Yeah, just David Getty UGA on Facebook and then David Getty on Twitter.
That's DavidGattie.
Yeah, it's Italian.
Yeah, and we'll engage with you, and you can hear his Italian accent for one more segment on Energy Matters. I'm Tim Eccles. Stick around for more fun.
The electric car revolution is coming, and the choices are growing. GEM cars are everywhere. You've seen these low-speed electric vehicles on college campuses, downtown Atlanta streets, and resort islands like St. Simons and Jekyll. GEM cars are street legal, equipped with seatbelts, headlights, and a tag, and can operate on roads with speed limits of 35 miles per hour or less. If you want to know more about these electric cars and trucks, six-passenger shuttles, mobile repair service, or full vehicle wraps, go to GEMCarService.com. That's GEMCarService.com.
Tim Eccles here for Solar Sun World. No doubt you've seen solar panels popping up all over Georgia. If you want the precision of German engineering when it comes to solar, Solar Sun World is for you. The folks there understand the complexities of solar and how to make it work, from tax credits to inverters to accelerated depreciation. They'll unpack it all. They've been in business for over 25 years. To find out more, go to solarsunworld.com. That's solarsunworld.com.
This episode of Energy Matters is sponsored by Arnold, Golden, and Gregory, an AmLaw 200 law firm with 180 attorneys in Atlanta and Washington, D.C. They take a business sensibility approach when advising clients. They provide industry knowledge, attention to detail, transparency, and value to help businesses and individuals achieve their definition of success. AGG subscribes to the belief not if, but how. We thank John Gornall and all the attorneys and staff at AGG for sponsoring our show. Welcome back to Energy Matters. I'm Tim Echols, your host. In the studio with us, Casey Boyce, my co-host. Casey.
Howdy, Tim.
Dr. Gaddy in for one final segment. You may never come back, Dr. Gaddy.
We'll see. Tim, yeah. It's up. Been treated pretty tough this yeah. morning.
Yeah. And actually, I'm one of your biggest fans, and folks would never know it with the arguing that we've had here. But one thing we really do agree on, and we do agree on an awful lot, but one thing we agree on is that the late David Blee, who passed away suddenly, it was a recent, just an allergic reaction to amoxicillin, and he was just gone. And he has been such a mentor to me, and you know him. You've had a chance to dine with him and visit with him and chat with him. It's a great loss for the nuclear energy industry, isn't it?
Yeah, David was a great champion of nuclear power. He's a great American, Tim. He was a really genuine person. He's going to be missed. Not going to be able to fill his shoes.
He's from Paris, Kentucky, and you know, I read his obituary to my children, and as I was reading his obituary, I would stop and say, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know that he was in the thoroughbred horse racing business.
Yep.
And that he was vice president of one of the longest-running thoroughbred operations in American history. Okay, I didn't know that. I didn't know that his dad was in the CIA, right? And that he was born in Pakistan, I think, and grew up in a couple of foreign countries. I didn't. And my wife and daughters who were listening to me read this, they go, I thought this guy was your friend. You didn't know all of this stuff. What did y'all talk about? Yeah. Well, we talked about nuclear energy because he was an absolute expert, passionate evangelist. I mean, he knew not just about the Westinghouse AP1000s, David, but he knew about reprocessing. He had been to all the facilities. He did a newsletter every month. He did conferences. It was incredible.
Yeah, and he understood the national security implications of nuclear power, too. He understood that, and that it was a real concern.
And I have made the argument, and folks can Google my name, Tim Echols, and Wall Street Journal and energy security, and you'll see an op-ed I did for the Wall Street Journal. I've written about it extensively. Dr. Gaddy, you've written about it extensively. That it is a security issue. I mean, guess what? Our submarines are running on it. Our battleships, not all of them, but some of them are running on nuclear energy. Our aircraft carriers are running on this. If you go down to the sub base in St. Mary's, Georgia, Kings Bay, you'll see more reactors there than we've got probably in the Southeast because they're sitting in submarines. So our military superiority allows us to have a certain amount of security, right?
Yeah, it does. And again, that's because nuclear science, engineering, and technology have been embedded in our industrial DNA for 50, 60 years. That's something we can't afford to just simply extract and lose. Once you lose institutional knowledge, you have lost institutional knowledge.
So maybe you guys can help me out here a little bit, because I'm sort of failing to see the linkage between civilian usage of nuclear energy as a generation source and the need to build and maintain reactors for military applications. We seem to be doing just fine with the Navy.
So
we're having a little trouble with Vogel.
So, KC, so the military part, I agree that we don't need to, and I try not to conflate my national security concerns with only the military concerns. I am really talking here about some broader, more global geopolitical concerns, and that is, not for the most part, but entirely, the U.S. has been the global steward of the nuclear fuel cycle because we invented this. This is our
Sure.
technology, our science, and our engineering. If we lose that industrial, that institutional knowledge. It is a matter of geopolitical reality. Someone else is going to take over. If they do, and the world's moving towards nuclear, they are building nuclear plants. They're building them in the Middle East. They're building them in developing countries. Somebody, some partnering country with the expertise is going to help shore those developments up. If it's not us, there are essentially four or five options. France, South Korea, and Japan, that's okay. Still needs to be us. But Russia and China simply is unacceptable. They are looking at those as not just relationships, but as leverages for influence. They want footprints in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
That's an 80 to a 100-year relationship where they get to influence those regions where they have...
Because of the technical capabilities.
That's right. And if the U.S. just simply cannot engage in that anymore, and I'm not teaching engineering students what a nuclear reactor is and how to design one, well, the world's option is they look to Russia and China. I said this in my testimony. We, the U.S., look at those relationships as relationships, friendly relationships. We are there to work with those countries. We don't have ulterior motives of trying to set a grappling hook in one of those developing regions so that they are so dependent upon us that they can't do anything without our permission. That's what Russia and China are setting themselves up to be. So we have to look at this strategically, which is why we can't look at nuclear as just a commodity. It is a strategic, and Russia and China make no bones about this, it is strategic for them because their nuclear industry is an extension of their State Department. Ours, Tim, to the point you've made earlier, right now is we're just hoping our capitalistic approach works. And we're going to need a new approach to this than to just try and compete. Westinghouse cannot compete with state treasuries. Can't do it.
Now, when you talk about the grappling hook that they may use to pull in another country, you think about nuclear energy, how complicated it is. I think Plant Vogtle is more complicated than building a spacecraft. It's certainly way bigger, more moving parts. If you think about a country like China or Russia, quote, trading... Right, this technology, so this country, whatever country it is that they're trading, let's say it's Turkey, which is definitely not a poor country or an undeveloped country, but you take a country like Turkey where we've had all kind of issues with them, even though they're in NATO, they are buying some Russian equipment. And if a country is trading with China and Russia for this very important energy resource, and then they start buying their airplanes from them and their night vision goggles from them and other military hardware, it really builds a special bond. I'm going to call it almost an ally type of a bond.
And if
we're ceding this to China and Russia, and I think we are, that's where the nuclear renaissance is happening. It's in China, they're building 25-plus reactors. It's in Russia, they're building reactors. We're sitting over here sputtering, barely able to finish the one here in Georgia, where in Asia, the renaissance is happening. And these countries, I believe, China, Russia, they're going to utilize this in creating greater political and military allies.
So, Dr. Getty, you talked in your testimony about orienting policy towards or away from nuclear. And to Tim's point there, you know, we are not a China or a Russia in terms of being a state-run economy, but how, like, if you were able to wave a magic wand, what would U.S. policy look like to support nuclear in the strategic way that you're talking about here?
So Casey, and I appreciate you asking that because I had kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I think you alluded to it, yeah.
The very first step, and let me, I want to give a shout out here real quick, Tim, to my colleagues at the University of Georgia. I'm an engineer and I can talk about the nuclear physics and things like that, but the essence of this issue that we're talking about here is a geopolitical issue. And the folks I work with, and I'll name them, Justin Conrad, Josh Massey, and Josh Darnell at the Center for International Trade and Security, when this conversation is being had, that's where international affairs experts that know what's going on out there, that's where they engage. And you don't have to be an engineer to understand that. But to your point, KC, our first step needs to be that we need to conduct a thorough industrial base review of the U.S. nuclear enterprise. What is the manufacturing and supply chain? What are the choke points? What are the weak points? What is our industry up against right now? We do this for the Department of Defense to ensure that we are able to stand up militarily our industrial manufacturing and supply chain. We need to get a benchmark of where we are in our nuclear industry as well, instead of just waiting for something to happen from time to time, a new scale reactor or a state to take on the risk of building a Vogel. We need something robust and strategic, and that needs to be done at the federal level.
So isn't the deregulated markets in electricity around America part of what's destroying nuclear power plants like Vermont Yankee and the Pilgrim plant?
It's the death knell. Absolutely. But again, you're going to probably get some pushback from those that think competitive markets. And this is, again, where nuclear cannot be looked at as just another energy commodity. That's not what it is. And this is the long game, Tim. Natural gas works for the next 3 to 5 years. Nuclear is a 50, 60 year investment. And you're right. The deregulated push has been an absolute anathema to the nuclear industry.
Well, there's so much more that we could talk about. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end our show. We're going to post a bunch of stuff on Twitter. So why don't you go to Matters Radio or Tim Eccles
or at Casey Boyce
and Dr. Gaddy. Get all your stuff at David Gaddy.
Yes, just David Gaddy.
David Gaddy.
It's not very hard.
David, thank you. Dr. Gaddy, thank you for being on the show today.
It's a pleasure, Tim. Thank you, Casey.
Thank you.
Casey, thanks for co-hosting again.
Yep.
I'm Tim Eccles. You've been listening to Energy Matters. We hope you have a great rest of the day.
Gas South believes in the difference we can all make, like the difference in putting people first and showing that you care. For us, our difference is saving people money with our best rates and no deposit, and the difference we make in our community by taking care of our friends and neighbors and giving back 5% of our profits to help children in need. Learn more about what makes us different at GasSouth.com. Gas South. The difference is good.
You've heard about Gem Cars on Energy Matters. Made by Polaris in Anaheim, California, these street-legal, small electric vehicles go where golf carts are not allowed. Equipped with seatbelts, headlights, optional doors, and a tag, Gem Cars and Trucks are perfect for shuttles, corporate, or college campus use. In fact, Georgia Tech has over 100 of them. The new generation Gems have many options when selecting the battery type, onboard chargers, and enclosures to suit the climate. Go to GemCarService.com to find out more. That's GEMCarService.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.